With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farm groups say the new Waters of the U.S. rule remains problematic. After the U.S. Supreme Court set boundaries for what bodies of water the federal government can regulate, some farm groups say they're disappointed. A revised rule, meant to conform to the court's ruling, fails to bring clarity and certainty to agricultural landowners. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issued a final, modified WOTUS rule last month. It took effect last week. And farm groups had hoped that the Biden administration would instead scrap its existing rule altogether and write a completely new one. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines. House bill targets California's electric vehicle mandate. The U.S. House of Representatives approved a bill prohibiting California's attempt to eliminate all gas-powered vehicles. The bill passed the House 222-190. It would keep states from limiting the sale of gas-powered cars and revoke any federal approvals allowing states to do so issued since the beginning of 2020. The vote was along party lines, but 8 Democrats did vote with Republicans in favor of the legislation. The legislation doesn't specifically mention California in its language. States can implement tighter clean car rules, stricter than those from the federal government under the Clean Air Act, but those states have to get permission from the Environmental Protection Agency first. The Hill says the EPA reinstated a waiver allowing a California rule aimed at limiting vehicle pollution to take effect. Since then, the state intends to completely phase out the new sales of gas-powered cars. The bill isn't expected to become law. NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's AgNet West's Brian German with more agriculture news.
There's optimism for building off of specialty crop advances made in the previous Farm Bill. Director of Government and Public Policy for the California Fresh Food Association, Adam Borchard, said greater unification of the specialty crop industry is helping to garner more broad support.
We made great advances in the 2018 Farm Bill, and we're hoping to build on those advances. And it does help for our industry that we're able to promote. It's a domestic supply of healthy and nutritious food for hopefully a U.S. domestic consumer base. So, yeah, we're optimistic that we can make further advances both on the nutrition front and then on various efforts within industry. And we're increasingly more unison, acting more in unison with our partners in different states and different organizations as well.
There seems to be a sort of resurgence of Bacchanay in California rice fields. Rice Farm Advisor for Sutter, Yuba, Placer, and Sacramento counties, Whitney Brim DeForest, explains what kind of an issue it can be for growers.
It causes the plants to like elongate really quickly at the beginning of the season. So you'll see the rice plants grow really, really quick. And so you'll see these, you know, weird looking plants sort of shoot up really fast. And then over the course of the season, they actually die. And so we're seeing it for some reason resurge. We're not sure why. It's usually treated by bleach soak before planting. So we do the water soak followed by the bleach soak. And that usually takes care of it. And we're not sure if we're seeing, you know, maybe people aren't using the bleach soak as much. We're not exactly sure why. And we did see a lot of Bacchanay this year. I would say I got a number of farm calls. I'm not sure, but more than normal related to Bacchanay.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, this is Farm Health and Safety Week. It started on Sunday and runs through Saturday the 23rd. Dan Neenan of the National Education Center for Agricultural Safety tells us about the importance of safety and health education campaigns, such as the National Farm Safety and Health Week.
For years and years, unfortunately, agriculture has led the nation in injuries and fatalities. That is in part due to the family farm is exempt from any and all OSHA rules that are out there. So that all takes its toll. We're happy to see that the number of injuries and fatalities are falling. I first started doing ag safety back in the year 2000, and we were averaging about 730 fatalities then. The last year we have data for is 2021, and there were 453 fatalities. So we're going in the right direction. Unfortunately, we're never going to reach zero during my working lifetime to be able to do that. So we've got a lot of work ahead of us.
To learn more about it, I talked with Laura Siegel, Health Communications Officer with AgriSafe.
It's just a really important week to have because agriculture, forestry, and fishing industries have some of the highest rates of injuries, as well as injuries that are fatal. So it's really important to get out there and spread as much important health and safety tips that we can. And this is just a good time to really get that information out there and to let other communities know about this as well.
So there's all kinds of farm safety concerns or ways that we should watch farm safety on the farm. Tell me about some of them and what farmers and ranchers and people who work on farms should be watching out for.
So some of the top causes for injuries include machinery, motor vehicles, accidents that happen with mud or in grain bins, and of course, there can be slips, trips, and falls or animal-related incidents. So really just making sure that we're fully mentally there for the workday, not distracted, not thinking about other things when we're doing the work can help kind of really reduce that chance. But just being aware that we need to be careful. Like if you're working with machines, make sure you're not wearing loose clothing, nothing's dangling down that could get caught. And again, just be aware of your surroundings. Even if you've taken this road the same day, same time for 10 years, you never know who else might be on the road or like maybe something filled and there's someone pulled off to the side. So just always being aware.
So let's talk a little bit more about what you are doing to bring awareness to farm safety and for Farm Safety Week. You mentioned a webinar. Can anybody attend that?
So AgriSafe is hosting 10 free health and safety webinars during the week. I can go ahead and go through the different topics. So the first webinar is ATV safety. The next one is chainsaw safety. Then the next day it'll be preventing the spread of infectious diseases in your farm or workplace, as well as cost-effective measures for prevention of long-standing infectious disease, again, in the workplace. And then the next day, we'll have cardiovascular health in farm workers with a concentration on females, then strategies to increase access to mental health services in the farm worker communities. And Thursday, we'll have confined spaces on dairy farms and saving lives in grain with strategies to prevent grain entrapment and how to respond to it if you're a first responder. And then on the last day for Friday, we're having conversations on access to lethal means training, and we'll also have a webinar for protecting your brain from stress. Anyone can attend. It's free to sign up to access them. You can just sign up for them through Zoom, and you can find them on our website at agrisafe.org/NFS. HW for National Farm Safety and Health Week.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, back in February of this year, the Opportunities for Fairness in Farming, or OFF Act, was introduced in the U.S. Senate. Senators Cory Booker of New Jersey and Mike Lee of Utah led a bipartisan effort to reform agricultural checkoff programs. The act would make checkoff programs more responsive to the farmers who are required to contribute to them. Efforts are currently underway, though, to put together an appropriations package to fund the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But according to National Cattlemen's Beef Association's Vice President of Government Affairs, Ethan Lane, Senator Lee is using this opportunity to attack the beef checkoff.
Senator Lee has had a long-standing problem with commodity checkoff programs. This is an old issue in some conservative kind of Heritage Foundation type circles objecting to the concept of a commodity checkoff. They view it as a tax. They view it as a government expenditure rather than producer dollars being spent to promote a commodity. And over the years, we've seen different versions of the OFF Act or you know, different challenges to the checkoff in this form. This year is different because Senator Lee has been joined by a pretty big contingent of radical animal rights groups. They've made this a big priority for them in the farm bill and just generally in their efforts to kind of derail animal agriculture. And unfortunately, Senator Lee has really capitalized on that added pressure on commodity checkoff programs and decided to push his legislation in the middle of this sort of shutdown, high-tension environment that we're in here in Washington at the moment. The Senate is going through their version of the appropriations process, and as is the way those processes work, there's an amendment process that goes along with that bill as it reaches the floor. So that bill, the OFF Act, has been submitted as an amendment to the Senate Agriculture Appropriations process and could receive a vote on the floor of the U.S. Senate here in the next few days.
And Lane explains why the OFF Act is so harmful to the beef industry.
The OFF Act is a mix of sort of messaging points that don't actually change the way the checkoffs work. You know, there are prohibitions in there on disparaging another commodity. Well, that's already the case with the beef checkoff and all checkoffs. And there's language in there that says you have to be transparent and make sure you can, you know, see where the funds are being spent. Well, that's already the case. You can go see where those funds are spent on the CBB website. You know, those are things that are already part of the transparency in the process. And it then goes further and restricts who can contract with the beef checkoff and makes it very difficult for these commodities to engage with the subject matter experts in different parts of their various industries, whether it be us or whether it be the soybean industry or whether it be mushrooms or watermelons or all the different commodities that are experiencing some concern here as part of this push. It basically takes the voice away from producers who are the ones directing these funds as part of these commodities.
Again, that was NCBA's Ethan Lane. NCBA has prepared a grassroots signed-on letter for producers in opposition to the OFF Act. You can learn more about it on their website, ncba.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Irrigation in arid California is as complicated as it is essential. Unpredictable supplies, uneven distribution, complicated application schedules, and regulation make it a challenge. No wonder help with water is the biggest request at USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. Since 2014, NRCS has invested over $100 million helping over 1,000 California farmers conserve water. By using superior technology and savvy management, farmers get more crops with fewer drops. Join the Water Savings Club. Contact your local NRCS office. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
If you noticed you are paying less for eggs these days, you're not imagining things. Gary Crawford has a story coming up in today's This Land of Ours report.
A friend of mine called me to task this week for my coverage of the latest consumer price index for food. His complaint was that I neglected to talk about the price of eggs, which for well over a year has been a top story in the food price arena. So I'm sorry. I'm going to get right to it now. The CPI, Consumer Price Index, says that last month the retail price of eggs went down by 2.5%, and compared to last year at this time, egg prices are down by 18%. I ask USDA economist Matt McLaughlin for the reason.
Last year, we had a large outbreak of highly pathogenic avian influenza among commercial egg layers. So far in 2023, we have not had a confirmed case among U.S. commercial egg layers.
Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report I'm Roger McGowan. The USDA has released its farm sector income forecast, and it's not a pretty picture. That makes risk management more important. A key element of risk management is tax planning. The USDA is projecting that net farm income will decrease 25% this year compared to last year. Contributing to the decline are lower government payments and higher production expenses. Government payments will be about 20% lower this year, and production expenses, including dwelling expenses, will be about 7% higher. Except for fertilizer, all other input costs are up again this year. Couple this with higher interest rates and inflation, and family living expenses won't be down either. In addition, cash receipts from the sale of ag commodities are forecast to decrease nominally by about 4% from last year. From a tax standpoint, make sure you aren't leaving dollars on the table. If you no longer need to be paying self-employment tax, are you structured properly to minimize or eliminate the tax? What about using farm income averaging or prepaying expenses? Also, take a look at your deferred payment contract strategy. Is it also time to harvest some capital gains? Rates probably won't be lower in the future. Keep tax planning in mind as part of your overall risk management strategy this fall. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Technology brings innovation in agriculture and to your home on the farm, but learning new technologies can be a challenge. AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel says AARP offers many resources to help.
Navigating new technologies can be a challenge for anyone. That's why AARP offers many resources to help you do so safely and securely. Technology helps us connect with our families from out of town and stay up to date on news, weather, and markets. That's why it's vital that rural residents have access to new technology and the ways it can help.
Voskel says one way to do so while saving money is the Affordable Connectivity Program.
The Affordable Connectivity Program helps low-income households pay for internet connectivity. Their program provides a discount of up to $30 a month for internet or up to $75 a month for those that live on tribal lands. In addition, the program offers a one-time discount of $100 a household on a device. You can access this valuable resource and see if you qualify at getinternet.gov.
Find additional resources and tips on how to best use technology from AARP's Tech Resource Center.
The Tech Resource Center provides many different tips and tricks that can help you harness technology to improve your life. You can find useful apps for your smartphone that can help you save money or even make money. The center offers tips on how to create secure passwords and information on how artificial intelligence can help you in the future. And you can find classes to help you learn new technologies at arpseniorplanet.org.
Learn more Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Clements reporting.
A program designed to support efforts of marketing, education within the nation's specialty crop industry.
The Specialty Crop Block Grant was established through the 2004 Farm Bill. Its purpose is really to increase the long-term successes of producers and broaden the market for specialty crops in U.S. and U.S. specialty crops abroad.
That's Agriculture Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, Jenny Moffitt. The first series of grants under this program were awarded in 2006. And recently, the latest round of specialty crop block grants were issued.
We just announced $72.9 million.
Divided among 55 states and territories.
To specialty crop producers, organizations that support specialty crop producers, as well as other marketing organizations across their state. Projects can include things like investing in food safety, investing in specialty crop research, such as focusing on conservation and environmental outcomes of specialty crops, developing new and improved seed variety for specialty crops. Pest and disease control are unique to specialty crops. Increasing child and adult nutrition, knowledge, consumption, and education of specialty crops, as well as improving efficiency and reducing costs for distribution of specialty crops.
The 2023 edition of the Specialty Crop Block Grant Awards are unique in that
this year marks an investment of $1 billion, $1 billion combined total since 2006 of these projects. So there are now 12,000 projects with $1 billion in investment for specialty crop block grants across the country.
The Undersecretary offers this advice to eligible entities interested in applying for USDA Specialty Crop Block Grant Award funding.
Producers, organizations that support producers, trade, and market marketing organizations should reach out to the state or territory Department of Agriculture to get information about when their application deadline is so that they can apply, what the qualifying criteria might be.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Higher energy prices can support commodities going forward. I'm Mark Oppold with today's bottom line report brought to you by Helena and Claas Equipment. Refuel your farm equipment for free thanks to Claas. Register to win $10,000 worth of free farm diesel. Go to fuel.claas.com. Fuel.claas.com. Spot crude oil futures remain the highest since mid-June of last year. Diesel fuel prices are the highest so far since New Year's. Strong energy prices, typically supportive to commodities in general, the price spread between December corn and December crude oil is the largest so far this year. That would suggest, based on history, corn is undervalued. Bottom line analysts suggest that farmers go hand-to-hand for gasoline and diesel fuel needs for now and do pricing at a 10 to 15% break for their spring needs. This is the bottom line report. Climate Prediction Center says there's a 95% chance of a strong El Nino January through March next year. That would mean a warmer and drier winter and spring. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
The need to expand agricultural literacy. A land-grant university professor is among those supporting expanded efforts to improve agricultural literacy across the country. USDA's Rod Bain talks with Kathy Liang of North Carolina A&T University in this report.
There are several and varying definitions of the term agricultural literacy when it comes to both understanding and use in daily practical application. So when it comes to the degree of agricultural literacy in the U.S., North Carolina A&T University professor Kathleen Leong says from her perspective and others,
I notice a lot of folks, whether it's young or old, in this generation, they are further removed from the rural communities, from the agricultural operations. A lot of young people don't quite understand how different type of crops grow, how different type of animals we raise them on the farm, what kind of challenges that farmers have to deal with.
Leong is among those using methods to improve agricultural literacy, doing so through educating teachers about the farm and potential career opportunities in agriculture for students, including through a curriculum supported by a USDA grant. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The NFU has their priorities for the Farm Bill. National Farmers Union President Rob LaRue says that it's clear the 2023 Farm Bill will not be ready before the September 30th deadline, and it could be a while before it's in place due to it being a presidential year next year. He stresses that the Farm Bill needs to have the right legislation for U.S. farmers and ranchers.
Just getting any bill done that doesn't kind of make improvements to the safety net, doesn't make improvements on the most recent farm bill, I think will be a missed opportunity. So it's not just about getting a farm bill done yet this year, but getting a good and the correct farm bill done.
LaRue says it's important the next farm bill has resiliency measures in it, such as a strong crop insurance program.
I think there's room to improve it by making some of those policies more available to more types of farmers out there. I think that looking at the commodity programs, I think there's ways to strengthen the safety net on those.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Let it go, let it go. Cold never bites.
bothered me anyway.
Ah, the big hit from Frozen, leading us into our subject, Kill the Music. Our subject for today, food safety and frozen foods. Meredith Carruthers is a food safety expert with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Meat and Poultry Hotline. Not frozen line, but hot line, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. Meredith has asked for some airtime today to sort of highlight some misconceptions that some people have about frozen foods and some mistakes that are being made involving frozen foods. She wanted to talk about this because
there have been a few outbreaks for salmonella that are linked to raw, frozen, stuffed chicken breasts that are already pre-breaded. You know, they have like broccoli and cheese or chicken cordon bleu, those types of products.
Not all of those kinds of foods, but some of them. And even though there might have been a processing mistake in which some salmonella bacteria somehow got into the products, there might not have been any problems actually resulting from those frozen foods, except for a couple of things on the consumer side of it. Number one, many of us think that if you freeze a perishable food, you kill any bacteria that might have been in it. But remember when Elsa was singing Let It Go, she said,
cold never bothered me anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true for bacteria that cause food-related illness. Instead of killing the bacteria, freezing merely yes, puts the bacteria to sleep in hibernation, just waiting for a chance to wake up and multiply. If the food product in question was fully cooked before quick freezing, the heat should have killed any bacteria that might have been in or on that food. Heating it and eating it would, in most cases, then be okay. But Meredith says in the case of some of these illness outbreaks, some consumers mistakenly thought the products that they had were fully cooked before packaging and only needed some warming up. The pictures on some of the packages might lead you to think that, but these foods involved and the outbreaks were frozen raw and needed to be fully cooked before being consumed. And the packages did have
very specific cooking instructions that people have reported not always following.
And so some consumers were just eating the foods right out of the package after letting them thaw out, whereupon the sleeping bacteria, sometimes present in raw meat and poultry products, began to wake up and multiply to the point that they made people sick. All of these leading Meredith to urge us to always read the cooking instructions on the packages of frozen foods.
Because some of those frozen foods are recommended to actually cook from the frozen state, because that's what's been tested by the manufacturer to provide the safest product. So if the package says cook from frozen, you don't want to then just take it straight from the box, put it in your lunch box, and then eat it that way. You'd want to make sure you're following those cooking instructions.
And that way you can make sure that
a convenience food doesn't turn into an inconvenience for you.
Yeah. If you have questions about frozen food safety or any food safety subject, just call the Meat and Poultry Hotline. Here's the number, 1-888-MP-Hotline, 1-888-MP-Hotline. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have a portion of the latest episode of the Farmside Chat. Again, to listen to the full conversation, visit fb.org.
We're going to go this morning to PepsiCo and two representatives that work there. I have Rob Myers with me, the VP of Global Sustainability. Welcome, Rob. And I also have Dan Christensen, who is the Senior Director of Government Affairs. Welcome, Dan. Thank you all so much for being with me today.
Yeah, happy to be here, Zippy. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm looking forward to it.
So PepsiCo, let's talk about the company a little bit. Introduce your company to my listeners. I think, you know, we know what Pepsi is and the Pepsi company, but I found out through a meeting that we'll talk about a little bit later with y'all that it's bigger and more than just Pepsi.
Yeah, people probably don't know PepsiCo as much as they know our brands. That's really how we engage with folks. And if they do see the words PepsiCo, they think Pepsi, and that is one of our brands. So we do sell a lot of beverages, but we're very much a foods business, and so we have lots of big food brands that you've probably heard of, like Lay's potato chips and Doritos and Tostitos and Fritos and Sun Chips, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're actually probably more of a foods business, more grounded in foods than we are beverages. When you look at our revenue, it's about a 60-40 split between foods and beverages.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I'm sure very, very few know that.
Probably so. Yeah. And when you think about what goes into those bags, you know, it's agricultural ingredients. Really high quality ones, and it's potatoes and corn and wheat, soy, canola, on and on. We source something like 30 ingredients from 60 different countries around the world. Our work in the U.S. is really important to our business because we still are very much a U.S. You know, we're a U.S.-based company, and the majority of our business, about 50-50, but slight majority of our business is in the U.S. And so the work that we do in the U.S. with the support from United States farmers is hugely important to the success of our business.
Wow.
Yeah, and to build on what Rob was saying there, Zippy, you know, I think that's probably one of the funnest parts of the job is telling people our brands that they don't know, right? Because invariably you'll get the response, oh my gosh, I didn't realize you guys were involved in Sabra hummus, or you guys were involved in Drew's, whatever it is. And, you know, the scale of what we're able to do is just really impressive. You know, if you look around the globe, consumers interact with our products a billion times a day, right? And then in the U.S. here, we're at 94% of U.S. households. Another way of saying that is, wow, if you have a kitchen, there's a pretty good chance one of our products is in it. So we just have a tremendous opportunity to connect with consumers, and you know, people really enjoy our products, right? I mean, again, like I was talking about, when you go through our brands, that's the other thing, you know, people say, oh yeah, I got that in my house. Oh yeah, our kids love that, right? So it's just a really fun company to work for as well.
We're so excited about our partnership with y'all and working with y'all, because you know, when we have other people that are using the things that we work so hard to grow on our farm, when we have them prepared to tell the story of American agriculture and why we do things, I mean, it just reinforces the trust that we know, and we've run surveys, the trust that people have in farmers. I'd like to just take a moment, Rob, and your Vice President of Global Sustainability. Tell us a little bit about what your job entails.
Yeah, I've been with PepsiCo for a long time. I joined PepsiCo in 1997, so I'm coming up on 27 years with the company. I started doing work kind of in our agricultural supply chain back in 2008 or so. And the work that we've really done since that point we didn't start kind of with sustainability in mind. We really sort of started with understanding a little bit more about, you know, the importance of farmers in our supply chain. We're a little bit different than some other food companies in that we do have some direct engagements with farmers. I mentioned our, you know, the potatoes that go into our Lay's brand. We have kind of a vertically integrated supply chain. So we have our own proprietary chipping, you know, potatoes that our farmers grow, and you know, their varieties that we've obviously developed and have made available. And so we've got kind of an end-to-end circular vertical supply chain. So we have direct engagements with farmers, and we have agronomists that, you know, that engage with those farmers directly. And so we've got kind of that as a long history. But for large parts of our supply chain, you know, we buy through the commodity market. And so you go back 10, 15 years, we didn't have a lot of understanding or visibility beyond that tier one, or the agribusiness that we bought the commodity from. What we really started doing back in 2008 was trying to understand a little bit more about where did our ingredients originate from, and who were those folks that were doing that work, and what were some of the risks that, you know, that they were, you know, that they were experiencing. And, you know, I don't have to tell you all this, but the farming is inherently risky to begin with. And then when you layer in, you know, climate change and policy change, and it's going to get more risky. I mean, we're seeing that in real life with the acute challenges that I think every farmer faces in some form or fashion with the weather in extremes, and you know, the chronic effects of climate change are only going to make that worse. And so for us, a lot of it was an eye-opening experience back then, you know, 15 years ago, to recognize that the you know, the risks that farmers face are real. They're gonna get more severe, and those risks we share. And so we need to not just understand them, which was the first step, but also sort of figure out what's the useful role that we can play to help farmers address those risks and keep them doing what is, you know, so critically important for our business. I think we'll have a hard time selling empty bags of with a nice Lay's logo, but selling air inside will be really hard, right? So having a, you know, a secure supply of ingredients is an important part of my job. Protecting the brands, the security of the brands, the reputation of the brands. You talked about trust. The trust that we have with our consumers through our brands is hugely important. And so sort of honoring that trust goes all the way upstream back, you know, to the farmers that provide the ingredients that end up in those bags. And so that's a huge part of my job. And, you know, the other side of it is to deliver our sustainability goals. We've recently come out a couple years ago with commitments to help support more regenerative and resilient agricultural systems with farmers on the land that they, you know, that they grow our crops on, and to source our products, our ingredients sustainably. And we have a lot of work that we do in the livelihood space. A lot of this is sort of embedded in the work, you know, because there's really no difference between whether you're a really small farmer farming on an acre in India or, a big, highly capable farmer in the U.S., that business component, that farming as a livelihood, is hugely important with everything you do. And so it's embedded in all of our work. And we've got some goals that we've set to try to really recognize the importance of that and hold ourselves accountable. There's a phrase we use, Zippy, that we sort of say a lot. I think we stole it from somebody, but I don't know who. It's that we need to be careful that we don't hit our goals but miss the point. And really, what we mean by that is that the point is everything I said at the beginning is that, you know, we don't have a business without a, you know, without a secure supply of high quality ingredients, and that's really the point. That's a lot of the work that my team and I are really focused on is getting at the outcomes that we're really trying to drive towards. Along the way, we're going to hit those goals, and they're hugely important. But the point is more about building resilience and making sure that farmers can continue to farm and have a farming livelihood, you know, kind of on into the future, because our business is absolutely critically dependent on that.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The 9th Annual Growing Together Latino Farmer Conference will be held in Stockton this year in November. The annual statewide sustainable agriculture conference for Spanish-speaking farmers is presented by the National Center for Appropriate Technology and the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. This year's event will take place at the Stockton Agriculture Center on November 1st and 2nd. Conference sessions will be taking place on day 1, followed by a farm field day on day 2. The sessions will include presentations from farmers and other experts in the field discussing topics including healthy soils, conservation, farm business management, and government programs and access to resources. The field day will consist of a visit to two local farms that are demonstrating successful business and ecological management practices. More information about the conference is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
In today's Ag Business Update from Agnet West, gearing up for the ASCA Annual Conference. More after the break. Registration is now open for the 2023 American Society of Ag Consultants Annual Conference. The conference, which showcases high-tech, unmanned spraying systems to state-of-the-art environmental recycling, business incubator facilities that support water, energy, and ag tech, and many other new inventions, will take place from November 5th through the 7th in Fresno. The conference will also feature sessions, including sessions on water rights and regulations, how economics is shaping the future of ag business, what makes California agriculture special, autonomous technologies, and more. Attendees will also take part in networking opportunities, wine tasting, and local ag tours. If you'd like to learn more and to register, you can visit www.agconsultants.org. Reporting for Agnet West Radio Network, I'm Danielle Leal.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.